Welcome to The State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris. Welcome, everyone, to State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. My guest today is Carrie Lawrence, who is one of the first female F-14 Tomcat fighter pilots in the United States Navy, call sign Vixen. As such, she knows well that inconsistent execution in fast-moving, dynamic environments can generate catastrophic results. Carrie has translated her training, leadership, and strategy experience in the Navy to helping business leaders supercharge their performance in today's competitive business environments, adapting strategies under pressure, reducing errors, and overcoming obstacles along the way. Her first book, Fearless Leadership, was a Wall Street Journal bestseller and explored the characteristics of true leaders: courage, tenacity, and integrity. Her latest book, Span of Control, picks up where Fearless Leadership left off, encouraging and guiding readers to develop resilience for facing hard times, offering a clear path out of the chaos when we are seemingly overwhelmed. Carrie is a selfless individual, the very definition of a servant leader, and I'm pleased to consider her a personal friend of mine. Welcome, Carrie, to my show, State of Readiness. How you been doing today?
Awesome. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You and I go back a long ways. I would guess maybe, 14, 15 years, something like that?
Probably. Yeah, I know. Math gets hard at this age.
It does. You know, I know it was before I moved to Germany, which is almost 11 years ago. So, it's been a while. And we were in Budapest together, if I'm not mistaken, in Milan.
Yes.
So that was a good show. Good times there. I really enjoyed it. So you helped me a great deal in the development of my book, State of Readiness. You had a blockbuster first book, Fearless Leadership, which is highly recommended to anybody that wants to learn about leadership and what it takes to be a leader. You've had some unique challenges in your career trajectory, and maybe we could share a little bit of that in a moment. But when I was writing my book, I had a lot of challenges, like who's going to publish it, what's the process? Where do I begin? And you had just launched your book, and I believe it made it to the bestsellers lists all over the place. I trust, admire, and respect, all of your thoughts. So I just followed your footsteps. You said you should do this, this, and this. And I said, okay. Because, I don't know how to write a book. I don't know the processes. You just did it. So, and I trust you. So it was like a no-brainer. So thank you. I wanted to thank you for your mentorship through that process.
Oh, gosh. Well, glad to be a part of it. And I love seeing all the success and the impact that your book has made as well. I mean, it's on shelves everywhere, certainly with lots of executives and operational excellence and continuous improvement professionals. So well done you.
Yay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. So, let's talk a little bit about your career trajectory, because it's, not the normal, one that a young high school / college graduate, would take. Take us through that.
Yeah, it was a little bit different. So I grew up in a family of service members. Lots of, people, both sides of my family have served in our U.S. Armed Forces. So I knew that I always wanted to do something that was service related, or something where I was in an organization that was very purpose driven. And I was drawn towards the Navy because of that value of mission before self. But when I was growing up, there weren't a lot of role models. There weren't a lot of women in aviation. And when I went to college, I did not go to the Naval Academy. I didn't go through an ROTC program. I was just a regular college graduate, if you will, at the University of Wisconsin. And I applied to the Navy's Aviation Officer Candidate School. So that's where people like John McCain, John Glenn, lots of really notable figures have gone through that training. And it's about a 16-week course that takes you from being a college graduate to earning your officer commission. But in that time, it's the funnel already starts to narrow. The applicants are oftentimes aerospace engineers, engineers of some sort, math majors, people who run a 4-minute mile, like just the best of the best. And I was none of those. I was reasonably athletic, couldn't run a 4-minute mile if my house was on fire ever in my life, even at my peak of athleticism. And I was a psychology and social work major. So, but you go through this program and they test you, right? They're seeing every single day, they're trying to break you either physically or psychologically to see if you are able to be flexible, if you can adapt and overcome any scenario that they really put you in. And then what they're also looking for is to see under extreme stress and duress and even adversity, will you be able to make good decisions still? And will you make a good decision that's in the best interest of the team when it's clear it's no longer in your personal best interest? And they want to push you to this point of paralysis or breaking to see if that, when you're at that point, will you be able to push through a fear of failure? Will you be able to still take action in spite of no guarantees of success, but just knowing what success maybe should look like and figuring out a path to still get there? So it was a pretty aggressive way to start right in the program. I graduated from that, hit flight school, knowing I wanted to, even when I started flight school, fly fighters. However, in the US, that was slightly, shall we say, problematic at the time, because there was a law in place that said women could not fly operationally in fighter aircraft. And why that matters is because that's pretty much the goal of most people, right? It's the cream of the crop. Only about 10% of the people going through every stage might even be afforded that opportunity. So the funnel narrows through nonstop right. Academics and flight training and all of that stuff. But I made it through that wicket and ended up being right at about a month before I was scheduled to graduate or earn my aviator wings. The Department of Defense actually lifted the law that prohibited women from flying in combat. So this is almost 2 years into nonstop training of, you know, barriers and people asking why you're there and pushback and what is this going to do to our culture? And is this social engineering and all this stuff? And, you know, again, I grew up in an aviator family. So I was like, I don't understand this argument right now, because the jet doesn't know the difference. The jet right. doesn't care. The jet doesn't care who's flying it, right? It's a technical skill. The jet doesn't know the difference. So why are we having this? How did the political discussion get wrapped into whether or not women could fly in combat? And not to dovetail on a totally different subject, but what was fascinating from my perspective, and although it sounds naive now in retrospect to say I didn't understand the politics behind it, in part because of my background and because of actually where I grew up. I grew up about an hour and a half north of one of the world's biggest air shows. Starting at about 11 years old, is when I first met one of the female military pilot, but who is not in the military. She was a former WASP, or was a WASP, one of the right. original women Air Force service pilots.
All right. So, and they flew the aircraft from the manufacturer basically to some forward destination, right?
Yes. Yes. And they did everything else but fly overseas in theater. These women flew over 2 million flight hours in 1943 and 44. They flew every single type of military aircraft. They did ferrying. They were test pilots. They were training the men who would then deploy. They were towing targets where the guys, the male pilots would do live fire practice training, like actually shooting weapons at them.
They didn't have drones back then.
No drones. And so they did all of it. They flew 2 million hours. And somehow after that war effort was completed, they were told to, you know, put away your flight jackets, put away your boots, your flight suits, and don't speak of this again. Go home and be good wives and mothers. You're done. And they fought to be recognized for not even just recognized, but the benefits they were promised. from the 40s to the 50s to the 60s. A couple of bills were started to be introduced in the 70s. Take a breath. Then we went through the 80s. We went through the 90s. Now, remember, I am now already flying in the early 90s, and it wasn't until 2009 that they were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. So again, I knew about all of this history and had met some of these women when I was 11 years old, and the rest of the country didn't know their story and completely forgot about them. So even while we were talking about the Tuskegee Airmen and different groups that were flying and were accepted, it was as though we totally forgot that women knew how to fly airplanes, even though they flew 2 million hours, which in those days, that's a boatload of flight time.
That's a boatload of flight time, period. It's a boatload of
flight time now, yeah. Right? So that's where, for me, you know, I still look at it and go, well, it might have been a little naive for me to not understand the extraordinary political football that women in combat became. And yet here I am now, a couple of decades later, I still have my foot firmly on the circus horse of, but they flew 2 million hours in the 40s. How did we forget that? Like, that's unconscionable. But that's a part of knowing your history and understanding why it is important for people to share a story or right. share their story and experience, even though you might not necessarily think it's notable or valuable, because you never understand and you can't know in today's time the long tail that may have
right.
and the opportunities and doors and whatever else it may open up from an industry perspective or even a demographic perspective. So it was a fascinating time. Lots of lessons learned for sure. Life lessons in the cockpit of an F-14. But it was an amazing experience. It was so lucky to be able to work with what I consider some of the world's best teammates. Some that provided coaching opportunities as well. Myself on more than one occasion, I promise you. But it was an extraordinary experience. One I'll forever be grateful for.
That's awesome. That's an awesome story. That would be the makings of a good book too. You know, from the 40s and the WASPs to today, you know, what is the timeline? What chain of events occurred when in order to culminate? Because, you know, now they have female fighter pilots in the Blue Angels. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the captain of one. No,
they don't. They don't yet. They had there was actually a gal in the mid 2000s who flew the C-130 for a time and then had to tap out for some personal reasons. They did have another C-130, Katie Higgins, I think. They had a C-130 pilot. The Blue Angels have not had a female fighter pilot.
Really? Really? I thought I read that. Well, I'm sure that you know more than I do on this subject.
Yeah, she's not a fighter pilot. She was a C-130. So it's a big fixed wing airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
Different propeller airplane, not a fighter pilot. So now the Thunderbirds, the Air Force Thunderbirds, have had quite a few women fighter pilots in there on the Thunderbird team, on the demonstration team.
Okay.
So the Navy's hopefully going to have one soon.
Maybe that's where I got confused. Maybe it was the Thunderbirds that I saw, the female fighter pilot. So that, you know, that's still an amazing story, and it should be documented someday. Maybe that'll be your next book. But why don't we talk about the one that just came out, or is about to come out, if I'm not mistaken, right? June of 2021, it's supposed to be released.
Yes. Yeah, June 1st. I have my advanced reader copies here. I'll have to send one overseas to you.
Please.
But my new book is dropping, or will have dropped, depending on when you listen to this, on June 1st. It's called Span of Control. And I am super excited about it. I think it's going to be really helpful.
You know, the title is captivating, Span of Control. Okay. Because, you know, I've owned my own business since 1985. And you and I have briefly spoke about the premise of your new book before, and it has caused me to reflect on that title several times, because as a business owner, there are certain things that are within my control and certain things that are not. Some things that are, you know, talents that are required that are within my wheelhouse and some that are not. And I think that, you know, as I made a transition in the early 2000s from being a small consultancy dealing with small clients to a big consultancy with big clients, you know, I knew that there was a lot of talent that I just didn't own. You know, I just didn't, and I had to learn how to release and to trust. And so this whole idea of span of control really resonates with me. But why don't you share with the audience and myself the details of the premise of the book?
Oh, I'd love to. So let me back up just a second, though, because you referenced it earlier. So in my first book, in Fearless Leadership, I addressed the individual principles and traits, if you will, of what being a fearless leader looks like, and then fearless leadership in action, addressing culture, vision setting, a good process, and how do you even build more resiliency within your team? But what I've discovered, so in the last, you know, in the last 15 years or so, I've worked with tons of Fortune 1, Fortune 500, the Forbes Global 2000 companies, helping people build their own individual leadership skill sets, as well as building high performing teams, doing strategic planning, account team planning, and some operational excellence work as well. But what I found in this experience over probably the last 5 to even 7 years is that clearly right now we're living in a time of really overwhelming chaos, change and uncertainty. And it's taking a toll on all of us, whether you're a leader, you're an owner, you're an entrepreneur, you're an educator. And every day it feels like there's more to do with less time to do it. So the biggest challenge that I'm seeing right now is that the opportunity of the moment is really to be able to figure out a way to overcome our circumstances instead of being overwhelmed by them. And the way we need to be able to do that is be very intentional with how we focus. Because if we're not focusing on the most important work every day, everything else is just a distraction. And there are real opportunities right now for success in these times of crisis or uncertainty, or a really, you know, I kind of feel like we've moved from the VUCA moment, if you will, where I think when people think they're operating in the VUCA environment, that there's been a misperception that we're going to get through that and get to an end point. But I think
that's the new norm.
Right. And that misperception, I think, has led to missteps in strategy and how we manage and grow and develop our people, and even our own personal expectations of what's possible. So in order to solve the problems raised by chaos, challenge, and uncertainty, you know, to make our big strategic goals and our commitments possible, we have to be very clear on what matters and be able to identify our priorities, find focus, and then navigate those obstacles. So span of control for me is not in the normal business. Sorry, just hit my desk. Hopefully it didn't make anybody's ears pop. It's not how we think of it historically as from a business org chart perspective, like what's my span of control? Here are my brackets. It's a framework for how a mental model for how you think about executing. So there are only three things, right? Because in my world, certainly in aviation, yes, we have lengthy checklists, we have memorization items, but when it comes down to the nitty gritty, the nuts and bolts, or what do I do if I'm on fire? Generally, it's always three things, right? So we're all about clarifying the complex. So I've netted it down to three things. The first thing is we have to be able to focus on what matters most. So the first thing is focus on what matters most. And this is going to be identifying your top three things and recognizing that everything else is just a distraction. Now, does that not mean that all of a sudden you can't have 17 programs or 17 things that you might be working on? No, of course, you know, you're running a multi-million dollar, multi-billion dollar company. You're going to have a lot of irons in the fire, if you will, but you can't have 17 equally as important things on an individual level you need to get accomplished to move your team's performance needle. So the first thing for span of control is being able to focus on what matters most. The next thing is going to be you have to formulate a flight plan for success. Now, within that, I have a process. That's a three-step process, which is just prepare, perform, prevail. You have to have a simple process. Nothing that's 18 pages long, or the people who are working on the floor or who are removed from you are going to nod their heads and smile. And they're going to do what they've done for the last 15 years. Great. Nothing's going to change. And then the third thing is we have to be able to communicate what's possible. This isn't about, you know, holly-go-lightly, just, oh, we're going to inspire our team, finger snaps for everybody. But this is, we have to figure out ways to communicate that are concise, precise, and clear so that vision that we've casted, the goals that we have, stated up as they trickle down, don't get fuzzier and more diluted to the people who are out there actually executing and implementing. So it's focus, formulate, and communicate. Those are the three big levers, if you will, under the span of control umbrella. I feel I just talked to Tom.
No, you know, it really resonates. And I'll tell you where it really resonates is beyond business leadership and, you know, business. This is down to the personal level. And I'll share with you, the saga of my oldest son, in the past year. You know, he won his dream job at Lufthansa Technik, okay, right there at Frankfurt Airport, you know, basically turning a wrench on airplanes, all right? And, you know, things were all hunky-dory, and it was on top of the world, and along comes one global pandemic, and, you know, the three runways at Frankfurt Airport, two of them turned into parking lots. And eventually, you know, he and 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 other people got turfed out. All right. So, he's hoping to get back in when, you know, things turn around. And of course, you know, he had the glowing recommendations and whatnot. But the thing is, when this was transpiring, what was within his span of control? Certainly the pandemic was not within his span of control, but how he's operating within that chaos, certainly parts of it were within his span of control. And certainly he had to prioritize based on, you know, what is likely to happen, what is unlikely to happen, you know, the iterations of this, what turned out to be a wicked problem. You know, when you make a decision in a wicked problem, you can't go back. You can only start from where you are. And so, you know, I'm looking at, you know, his, and he got a job, you know, he was only out of work for a couple of weeks. So it wasn't, you know, a tragic event as some people have experienced.
Right, right.
But, but while he was going through this, you know, and you mentioning the premise of your book about the same time, maybe a little bit later, I started thinking about how it applies to individuals in their lives, not just professionals in business. You know, we see a lot of young people that are overwhelmed, you know, and it's because they think that everything is important and everything requires the same amount of attention and level of energy and level of engagement. And what they really need to do is they need to prioritize. Okay. If everything's a priority, nothing's a priority, right? So they have to prioritize and focus on those priorities. So I really think that this book and your message is going to goes beyond the boardroom, beyond the C-suite, beyond the middle management. It goes down to, you know, everybody, down to even the college student. You know, what projects 100%. Need to be worked on. You know, so
100%. And that's where, you know, I'm keenly aware. And for literally for the last 30 years, I've been researching, studying, and I'm fascinated by the metrics, if you will, the mechanics of success and high performance from a psychological perspective, from a team perspective, from an execution perspective. So this isn't like pie in the sky, you know, woo woo, you know, whatever, get your crystals and your velvet hammer type of thing. And if that works for you, that's awesome. That's not how I'm wired. And that's not what this premise is based on. It is based on loads of science, of tons of surveys that I've done, of research, and watching the difference that it makes in action for people. Right. And all of the, you know, there's, I have yet to find a body of research or a piece of research. And if anybody, any of your listeners finds it, feel free to forward it my way. But everything that I have found and researched and is shown to be true is that action conquers fear. And having this framework that becomes a mental model that's built on how do you make good decisions? How do you understand what task overload looks like? And this is both from a leadership perspective and an individual perspective where, you know, if I hear any more anybody say, you know, don't just work, you can't just work harder or work smarter. Okay, what does that even mean? That doesn't give me the tools to be successful. It makes me want to flip you off and tell you to sit down. Right? That's not helpful. It feels condescending to me. You know, I've run a business. I have four kids. I still run a business. I sit on boards. Every day I am juggling glass balls. Every day. Not just hoping I don't drop the most important ones. I have to actively and intentionally plan or have enough mental models in place so that I don't drop the most important ones. And we can't leave success to chance. And you've heard me say this before, and I will push back when I hear people grumble and say, well, hope is not a strategy. I'm also going to wave the BS flag on that one, because if you are in a leadership position, and I posit to you that everybody right now, whether you are an individual contributor, you are out of the workforce right now for whatever reason, or you are the CEO of a multi-billion dollar company, you are in a leadership position because somebody is watching you and you have the ability to impact and influence people regardless of what your title says. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand the power in being able to inspire people and give them hope and be solutions oriented, instead of being a Debbie Downer or the, well, that's not ever going to work. Okay, well then bring me a solution. Or can we figure out a different way to have this discussion? It's, you have to be, span of control gives you the skills and the tools to be able to see what is possible while navigating what is. And that's not BS woo-woo. Everything's going to be fine. Just hang in there, right? Because that's just not helpful for the overwhelming majority of us.
Yeah. Happy, so, friendly people holding hands.
Yeah. So I much prefer, I like looking at science. I like looking at the research on both sides. I like being able to see what works for people. I like the psychology of it, understanding the accountability that we each have to recognize not only how we're wired, but to be able to pick up on signs and signals from our teammates to see if they are on the cusp of burnout, to see if maybe they're feeling overwhelmed, that they're not just a jackwagon. And then how do we get to a place that's more valuable than where we are today? Not just from a money perspective, yes, that too, but just building better companies, better communities, better teams, and better families. And I think it's possible. But not when we are getting distracted, not when we are pulled 1,000 different directions and we're diluting our focus. Because at the end of the day, if you dilute your focus, you dilute your power. I don't care how fantastically talented your team is or your managers or your front, you know, your frontline workers or your manufacturing line. If you are diluting their focus, you're diluting their power. And right. You will always be less than and less resilient than maybe you could be, less prepared for the next big wave of disruption, or even less innovative.
Right.
And it doesn't need to be freaking complicated, but you do need to have tools in your toolbox in order to navigate a better path forward. So I hope that's what this gives people. Easy to read. Once again, just like Fearless Leadership, you know, I wrote it. So not too many 9-syllable words. If you're looking for a PhD level dissertation with super fancy words, this is not going to be the read or the listen for you. I want to give people stuff that's super freaking actionable and that they can go, yeah, this is going to help me.
Well, that's what I've enjoyed about your Fearless Leadership. You write in an approachable fashion. You know, you tell great stories, okay? Anecdotes that tie the reader to the content, the real meat and potatoes of it. Any high school graduate should be able to read it with relative ease. You don't try to impress them with your vocabulary. You impress them with your messaging. So I'm sure that it's going to be a smashing hit.
Ah, thanks, Joe. Yeah, you're welcome. I am really excited about it. It's been, yeah. It took me, I tell people, and I share with people, I've had this idea and that I wanted to write this probably for almost 7 years. And because I was traveling nonstop, I was doing so many events. It's hard for me to, when I actually started getting everything and pulling everything together and committing to a date that, okay, this is my goal of when I want to put this on my office floor. I pulled out and aggregated, and printed out Word docs, all my legal pads, exactly like, I started writing my first book and put them on my floor. And I had over 185 pages that I'd actually already written. And I even got a tattoo with the little that my daughter designed a couple of years ago, because for me, it's not just a mantra. It's not something that I'm trying to just throw out there as a sticky little catchy ism that somebody will remember. It is something that I think, regardless of what your day job is and regardless of where you find yourself personally, that you will find value in this that'll allow you to take a breath and figure out what does success look like for you and then start hitting those levers. That isn't going to require some 17-page app. You can't, Excel spreadsheet your chart way through this necessarily, but it's taking a little bit of time to reflect on what are the most important things for you that'll move the needle either personally or professionally. And then there are the tools right there for you to do that, right? So I'm just beyond excited about it. I'm super excited.
So you're going to go on
I'm Midwest stoic. So for me to be saying, I'm actually really excited about this, like I feel like I'm bursting out of my shell right now because I am really excited about it. I think it's going to be awesome.
I've never known you to be stoic or an introvert. Maybe it's because we're comfortable with one another, but you are a center of gravity. You influence a great many people, pretty much anybody that crosses your path, I would imagine. Certainly you did with me. So you're going to have a nationwide book signing tour?
We're going to see how that goes. So June 1st, as you can imagine, again, depending on when you're listening to this, I don't think anybody's really sure about what's going to be happening. So we're trying to figure that out. We're navigating that every day. Right. We're about to the beginning of April. We're going to be starting to do all the pre-launch rollouts. I try to be really respectful of my, the people I'm connected to. I don't want to say my audience, but the people I'm connected to, even on social media, I think for all of us, we've been on the receiving end of people who just nonstop pummel you with their book launch stuff. And it starts feeling kind of icky. So I don't want that to happen. I don't know that that'll be the case, but we'll see. I don't know if in-person book launch signing events are going to be a thing yet.
Yeah.
At the beginning of June. So respectful of that, we made an investment with, if you're an Audible person, even I went to, and for people who are like music people or audiophiles, this will hopefully you'll find this exciting. You're listening to the podcast, so you already probably are, but I recorded my audiobook at a legendary studio down in Austin, Texas, where the Foo Fighters have recorded, and Coldplay and Bonnie Raitt and just countless other people that, I just think it's going to be awesome. So, it'll be available on, you know, in hardcover on June 1st, the Audible version will be out there. Ebook will be out there, but I don't know about in-person book signings yet.
Yeah.
It's TBD.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, right now in 2021, everything's TBD as far as face-to-face is concerned, but you know, I'm sure you're like me, you're itching to get back out in the field. The sitting at home stuff is not for me.
Yeah. You know, it's had its pluses and minuses for sure. Again, I have four kids, so I went through a period of time. My youngest two actually just went back to school in person on March 15th. So it's been a year for them. So we had to upgrade even more all of our Wi-Fi or our system, because, you know, you have four people on Wi-Fi doing Zoom school or, you know, all of the virtual stuff. And then I'm trying to do virtual events. I will share with you the one upside that I have found. My experience has been in large virtual events, when the client chooses to also have the Q&A function where you can see the chat box, it has been amazing, because when you're in an audience or you're doing a presentation for 500 people or 3,000 people or 6,000 people, there are a lot of people who would rather not ever eat carbs again than raise their hand in front of 6,000 workmates.
Yeah,
but they will ask a question in the chat feature.
That's cool. Yeah, I'd never thought of that.
Yep. So that part of it I love, because you can see all the questions coming in, and you can very quickly, you know, douche, 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 interact with people. So that part of it I've actually liked. I think it's been a bit of an equalizer for people to ask questions that they never would have in person. So it's a different way for sure. But it depends how you leverage it.
Awesome. That's awesome. Well, listen, Carrie, thank you very much for taking the time out of your day to have this conversation with me. I really appreciate it a great deal.
Oh, gosh, I am glad to be here. And thank you for sharing your time and even your audience with me. It's been a pleasure, Joe. I have deep respect for the work you do and gratitude for our friendship as well. So thank you.
Thanks. You've been listening to State of Readiness. I'm Joseph Parrish, your host, and our guest today has been Carrie Lawrence. Her new upcoming book is Span of Control. Make sure to get a copy.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Parrish of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Parrish at www.josephparis.me/card.